remember a time of chaos, ruined dreams, this wasted land. But most of all, I remember the road warrior, the man we called Max. To understand who he was, you have to go back to another time.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, Mad Max Retrospective Series.
Not this again! I've been assigned!
Join Garrett.
Perfect in every way.
Matt.
You. It's your lucky day.
And the returning Mick Duffy.
Remember me.
As they review the franchise that revolutionized low-budget filmmaking.
Hey, listen, man. Listen to me.
From the gritty 1979 Mel Gibson starring original.
I've seen the style before. Terminal Psychotic.
To the 2015 mega hit, Mad Max Fury Road.
Max. My name is Max.
All the way to George Miller's prequel, Furiosa.
This one has all their teeth.
The boys will review each film in the series, one car chase at a time, to see why and how this franchise just keeps on going.
Together, they can be very powerful.
So strap yourself in, percolated media listeners.
What are you doing? Praying to who? Anyone that's listening.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Mad Max series begins now.
Now we bring home the booty!
Mad Max, released April 12, 1979. Budget on this was between $350,000 and $400,000. Box office is over $100 million U.S. dollars. And this was directed by the one and only George Miller. I am joined for this amazing retrospective, first by the one and only Matthew Goudreau. Matt, thank you for joining me on this road trip.
Not like I have a choice at this point.
And, you know, we have brought Mick on, Matt, for horror series. He's been our horror go-to. We did Nightmare on Elm Street. We did Friday the 13th. Last year, we cursed him with The Exorcist. Mick, is it safe to say that I don't think there was a series more meant for you than Mad Max?
Oh, yeah. It is definitely the film franchise I've been most interested in, both as a teen and, you know, as an adult. And it's kind of funny because this is the first time you and I have discussed something that isn't horror, but it's also the mm-hmm. first time you, Matt, and I have discussed something that isn't an American product.
Yeah, that was another reason I wanted to bring you on. That's why I kind of said you were kind of perfect for this. And at the time this airs, you know, I would have already spoken to my friend Marcy, who's also in Australia. We talk a little about Ausploitation. And apparently this is an Ausploitation film, a very successful Ausploitation film. But you know what? Until I started this retrospective, Mick, I had never heard the term Ausploitation. Can you define that for people who didn't listen to the Super Marcy show?
Yeah, it's the sort of blanket term used for one of the two types of films that Australian cinema produced during the 1970s, where you have the one hand, you have the sort of respectable sort of cinema that Australia was starting to make then, in which we're going to lump things like sort of early Peter Weir films, like Picnic at Hanging Rock. And then you have the films that were, you know, made cheaply but were widely popular with Australian audiences, like there's a series called the Alvin Purple films, and they're basically sort of body sex comedies. And you have various sort of low-budget action films, such as sort of Brian Pritchard Smith films, like The Man from Hong Kong. And there's a great Mark Hartley documentary about Ausploitation called Not Quite Hollywood that offers an extremely thorough overview of this entire wave. And it's kind of interesting. It's the respectable Australian cinema from that era is very respectable. And the drive-in schlock, because, you know, Australia has drive-ins, is very much sort of the Australian equivalent of the kind of drive-in fare that API would have been making, or that sort of New World would have been making in the 70s. You know, it's a, you know, there's emphasis on sex and violence, and the production values aren't terribly high.
Yeah, we'll talk about production values throughout the course of this film. Matt, it's our first set of foreign films with Mick, but it's also the first time you and I have spoken about Mr. Mad Mel Gibson. I'm sure there's another series he's in that we will get to eventually, but Matt, what do you feel about old Mad Mel here?
Well, as far as this series goes, I've been trying to find a way to get us to review it in some format, and lo and behold, I saw Furiosa was coming out, and I'm like, perfect. Because I've been trying to do this franchise basically since you and I have ever started doing this format, which was right around the time Fury Road was coming out. So it just never coincided. There was some other stuff that we chose to do instead. But I've been meaning to talk about this for a while, because despite me being a fan of the Fast and Furious franchise up to a point, this is the precursor to that. When I think of like car exploitation as a movie franchise, it starts and ends here. As it pertains to Mel Gibson, you're right, we haven't really done Lethal Weapon. Who knows if the fifth one ever comes out, we'll actually do that series. Or who knows if it'll be on the schedule already, because we have mapped a few years out.
Yep.
So it's weird going back and watching this, and I've seen this movie a bunch of times, but you look at him, how he looks in this movie versus even The Road Warrior 2 years later. He looks like he's fresh out of college in this movie compared to the Wolverine-esque persona he put on for The Road Warrior.
Yeah, and he had been in at least one other production that I know of, but this was pretty much his first pretty big role, right, Mick?
Yeah, he'd been in a small Australian indie film called Summer City, which I'm not even sure it got wide distribution until after Mel Gibson became famous, and it's very cheap. I've never seen it, but it's apparently very cheap and generally terrible.
That's what I've heard, too. As far as my road to this franchise, you know, I think when this was coming out, I was just a little too young. I was into Star Wars. I was into everything else that was coming around that time that Matt and I have covered, Indiana Jones. But Mad Max just never appealed to me. It's just one of those things that it just passed me by, you know, like I was on a road and it just drove by me. I think I tried watching Road Warrior when I was younger. I couldn't really get into it, turned it off, or maybe my dad was watching it and I just kind of left the room. Now, when Fury Road was coming out, I did do a deep dive. That was the first time I actually sat and watched all three of the original films, and I think they're okay, and we'll get into it as we get into the franchise, but my interest coming in is, now that we've gone through as many franchises as we have, Matt and Mick, am I going to feel differently about how this series is? Because when Fury Road was coming out, I'll go ahead and say right now, to preview my thoughts, I thought it was one of the most overrated movies I'd ever seen. Now, who knows? Yeah, well, that was just at the time. I'm just giving it at the time. This was 9 years ago. And by the way, that was the last time I saw it. I have not watched it since. I am curious to watch it again. And you know what? These Furiosa trailers came out, and believe it or not, they got me a little bit excited. First of all, I love Anya Taylor-Joy, as I've said on the show many times. And I love the fact that George Miller is, what, in his late 70s at this point? And here he is making another one of these? It's remarkable to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly maybe 20 years ago, the conversation around this particular film was about it starting the career of Mel Gibson. But I think now, at this point in time, and in the longer view when we're talking about the film history, I think all the conversations about this movie really have to be predominantly about it starting George Miller's career. I think that's the more interesting career and the more influential one as well, because the production company that he formed to make this, you know, has been very active in Australian cinema and produced other films that he didn't direct. Yeah, it's an important film in Australian film history, to put it mildly.
Definitely. And its importance is very evident. When me and Matt and Adam did Star Wars last year, I said during that podcast, I don't think Star Wars is the best movie ever made, the original, but I do think it's one of the most important. I think this series is one of the most important as far as indie film goes, because this held the record as the biggest grossing indie film for a while, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And it also, I think this trilogy has a lot in common with Star Wars, actually, when you look at the way it's talked about. You know, you have the first movie, which was a lot more small scale comparatively to the previous two. Second one was regarded as one of the best sequels ever made, generally speaking. And then the third one is often criticized as being overly kiddified in comparison. Very similar to how the original Star Wars trilogy is perceived.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very valid. There's this broad brush perception we have of these original three films. I'm not sure it's entirely accurate in every front, but what I will say that always fascinated me about these movies is, and again, I've mentioned before, this is the first time we've covered something that's not American, and I'm not American.
Uh-huh.
As you all have noticed, my first awareness of these films And again, this is coming by a strange sort of a series of cultural importations. But my first awareness of these films was via Marvel UK. Because when I was a kid, you couldn't get American Marvel comics. You had to get the UK reprints that were running like a decade behind and were chopped up and reformatted. And, you know, they were generally strange. But this range of comics and magazines covered things from like their Spider-Man weekly comic through to things aimed at older readers, like the film magazine Starburst and sort of reprints of Savage Sword of Conan and things like that. So this meant that when they sold ad space, they would be selling ad space, as far as I can tell, for the entire line of things they were publishing. So there would be things advertised in Spider-Man Weekly that weren't suitable for, like, me as a 10 or 11-year-old. They kept having this back page ad, which was for a series of soundtrack albums available from the label Varese Saraband. And they were all for kind of like horror and sci-fi films.
I remember that label, yeah.
And some of them I'd heard of, like I knew what Videodrome was, because I'd seen TV trailers for it. And I knew what Creepshow was because I'd heard kids in my school talking about it. And then there were four titles along this thing, and I had no idea what they were. And three of them were Escape from New York, and two of them were Mad Max and Mad Max 2. And I remember my brothers and I looking at these, like, these covers of these albums in this advert and going, what on earth are those movies? And having an argument about, are these science fiction movies? Or are they set in the present day? Because album art for the first movie soundtrack, it was just like a variation on the American one sheet for it. Mm-hmm. The painted image of a figure with a helmet and a sawn-off shotgun and the car behind him. And we couldn't figure out whether it was meant to be present day or the future. We figured it had to be the future because it was grouped with all these other things that were sci-fi and horror. For years, I had no idea what these movies were. They were a thing, and I kept occasionally hearing stuff about them. Yeah. But I never knew what they were.
And when did you finally get to watch them? Probably in your teens, I would guess?
My 13th birthday, I saw the second one.
13th birthday?
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing that it originates where you are. But yet, us dumb Americans, we get everything first, and you guys have to get it, like, months later. That blows my mind.
Well, yeah, except with these. I think we got most of these films, certainly the first two, played in the UK before they played in the US.
Oh, okay. George Miller. Now, Matt, you and I, we spoke about him a little bit last year when we covered Justice League. He had a version of that he was working on. In fact, one of my best friends is a visual effects artist, and he was actually helping conceptualize that when they were in the early stages of it. So he almost had a hand in doing a superhero film, but he stuck around as this filmmaker who, you know, he's done these Mad Max movies, but he has such a weird resume because he has Babe, he has Happy Feet. You're not going to get a more diversified resume, are you, Matt?
No. And he also has a very diverse background. Unlike most filmmakers, he was a ER doctor.
Yes, he was a medical doctor.
He started making movies, which is kind of where the genesis of this Mad Max thing came from. But it was so funny to be realizing, because I grew up on Babe, and especially Babe Pig in the City. And when you learn that it's written, and in the case of the second one, directed by the Mad Max guy, it kind of blows your mind. And then you look at some of the other, like he did The Witches of Eastwick, he did, what was that, Oil? The movie with
Lorenzo's Oil.
Lorenzo's Oil, it's the one with Nick Nolte. And then he's still alive, still making movies, which is surprising given his age and the scale of, based on what I'm seeing in the Furiosa trailer alone, I am still skeptical about, to be honest, but we'll talk about that in a couple weeks.
Mick, how big is Miller in your side? I mean, he's probably pretty big over there, isn't he?
I don't think he's a filmmaker yet whom the general public have heard of, in the same way that everyone knows who Christopher Nolan or Steven Spielberg is.
Yeah.
I don't think he has achieved that, but I think for people who are, you know, film fans or cineasts of any kind, I think it's a name that has meaning and is known.
My favorite story or legend that associated with George Miller has to do with the Twilight Zone movie, because he happened to be walking by when there was a meeting going on with it, and he said, let me throw my hat in here, I want to do one. And Spielberg and Landis at that time, and Kathleen Kennedy and them, they kind of put their heads together. They were like, yeah, go ahead. We'll have you do the remake of Nightmare 20,000 Feet. And by the way, it's by far the best segment in that movie. And so he has touched his hand in horror, too. But I've always loved his segment in Twilight Zone movie. Matt, you've seen that, right?
Yeah, it's the best one by far. And for the record, Spielberg's is the worst one. And it's not even...
By far, yeah. He was going to do something else, and then a certain accident happened that Well, we're not
going to. Yeah, Spielberg was going to do The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street.
Yes, yes.
Which is such a classic Twilight Zone episode, and it would have been great to see a top-of-his-form Spielberg attempt that material.
God, I am so sad we didn't get that.
Yeah.
So, as Matt mentioned, George Miller was a medical doctor, and he did take what he saw on the job of people just getting impacted by these cars, and he puts it in a script. And then him and a producer by the name of Byron Kennedy, they helped fund the movie by doing 3 months of emergency calls with Kennedy driving and Miller doing the doctoring. You will never see a movie get made like this.
No, especially, you know, this is back in the day because Australian cinema was virtually non-existent after World War II. It wasn't until like the mid-60s that the Australian film department actually started putting out work. So unlike a lot of other countries when it came to filmmaking, Australia's never really had to worry about unions that much or guilds or anything of that ilk. They were able to do a lot more shoestring type of movies, which is why Ozploitation even became a thing, because they were so cheap to make and they could just kind of pigeonhole themselves into, I mean, most of them are biker movies, horror films. Mm-hmm. There's some martial arts movies, but they're not on the quality of something that you see from like a Bruce Lee. But it's so popular that a lot of people, when they think of Ozploitation, I think of what Tarantino was trying to do with Death Proof. That's kind of the closest thing you'll see an American filmmaker approaching this style, at least over the last like 20 years.
Now, when they were outlining this film, it wasn't going to be a dystopian film at first. They were going to set it in the future and in a city. But you know what? It's a lot cheaper to make a dystopian film, isn't it, Mick?
It's a lot cheaper just to say, yeah, it's the future. Stuff don't work. We're shooting in this derelict lot now.
So they made it this future out of basically necessity.
That gives you the freedom to change the designs you're using. Because I don't know if you've Googled pictures of like mid-1970s Australian police officers, but they don't look cool.
No, I have not.
They don't look cool. they look cool now, and they've looked cool since the 80s, because, you know, they do wear leather jackets and such like, but, you know, at the time they did not.
Wow.
Yeah, they just look ghastly, and the cars don't look as cool. So getting to design your own world means you get to change what cops look like and what their vehicles look like, and that's one of this movie's big assets.
Now, at the time, Australia was going through a pretty big oil crisis, wasn't it?
Well, Australia and everywhere that wasn't the Arab state. You know, this film's frequently discussed as a reaction to, you know, the oil shocks of the 70s and the fear that there had already been kind of disruptions and embargoes and such like happening in the 70s with Arab oil-producing nations, and the fear that the spigot might be turned off at their end, and that might, you know, again, you see this in footage from the US at the time as well, you know, the long queues outside gas stations, same thing in the UK, same thing in Australia, you know, the OPEC oil shock in the 70s kind of reminded people that oil is a finite resource and that, again, you can be denied it, and you know, so it's sort of a dystopian theme.
Now, I've been on sets that have paid people with pizza. And I mean, there are certain things that if anybody's ever seen Living in Oblivion, me and one of the directors I worked with, we would always watch that and just laugh because that was pretty much our sets. If you see the beginning of that film, the people on this film weren't paid much better because they were paid in beer. The very big set of guerrilla filmmaking. The another thing about this too, boys, is, and Mick, I know you know this, but if you watch this original version, everything's overdubbed. Yep. The only thing that's not overdubbed is the voice of the singer, who is the only real voice of the film. Even Mel is overdubbed.
Oh, no, wait a second. Have you guys been watching the terrible American AIP redub of this? Famously, when this got picked up for distribution in the US, it was picked up by Samuel Z. Arkoff, and AIP picked this up, and they had it redubbed into American. Wow. So, God, I hope that's not the version you guys have been watching all these years.
No.
But that's sort of a ghastly version. But, like, there's a lot of the audio recording of this movie isn't great. I was watching this with my headphones on, and there were one or two points where, like it's fine, but there were one or two points where I'm going, like, oh, on a film that had a larger budget, you'd do ADR and you'd re-record that line.
Yeah, the sound mixing when it comes to the dialogue sometimes is inconsistent, but I think it's offset by the audio work that goes into all the action scenes, which is also really impressive. We should talk about that the stunts in this movie were not done by licensed professionals.
No.
Well, I mean, they did have a professional stunt coordinator. They had Grant Page,
But he didn't do the actual stunts, though, is what Matt's
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, well, but, I mean, it's kind of weird in that stunt work has often been very poorly regulated. So I think anyone who does this on film for money or any kind of payment deserves sort of the same respect you would give somebody who's a professional, even if they've not done it before, if that makes sense.
Now, the film was not well received by critics when it came out. And in fact, initially, it wasn't even that big of a film of a moneymaker. It kind of grew by word of mouth. It's one of those classic cases of people kind of hearing about it, and then it eventually ended up growing over $100 million, which is just remarkable, because this thing, $350,000, it's unbelievable to me that they got this made for that much.
Well, yeah, but again, it's their most expensive actor is Roger Ward, and now, he's an Australian character actor who's in everything. When I first saw this movie, I knew who that guy was, because, you know, you can't watch, there's a lot of Australian television end up on UK and Irish TV when I'm a kid, and I have seen this man. I've seen him acting in things.
Wow.
Yeah, he's like, oh yeah, that guy. He was very much one of those that guys, you know?
That guy.
Yeah, he does have a distinctive frame and face, so I knew him, but, like, he's the most expensive actor in this, and they had him for a week. And his, you know, they paid him what, like a, I was looking at Luke Buckminster's book on the making of these films, which is sort of indispensable, but yeah, I think he was paid, I think it's $1,000 was his fee, you know, nobody's getting paid an awful lot acting this, which isn't a reflection on the actors, because some of them do some really fun work here, but it's, your cast aren't expensive, they're not building any set, so that all the money can really go on vehicular stunts and vehicles getting destroyed.
If you're a fan of this franchise and kind of want to learn more about this new wave of Australian cinema, there's a great documentary called Not Quite Hollywood, where it's all about 70s and 80s, like, low-budget Australian cinema. And they interview everybody from George Miller to Stacey Keach, Jamie Lee Curtis. It's really worth checking out if you haven't seen it.
I'll definitely be checking that out as we get into the series. So, we start off, we get the familiar lion roar of MGM, and we get a title card that says a few years from now. We see a sniper overlooking a couple and taking aim, but no, it ends up being the cops just fucking with this couple. Now, of course, this is going to be revealed as these cops having fun, but this was something that was prevalent in the 70s due to the presence of the Zodiac Killer, right in California. Clint Eastwood, he did a Dirty Harry film based on this, and Miller is kind of doing the same thing here, kind of playing off the fears of the public.
See, this is weird, because during my childhood, I remember at several points while playing in the school playground that I was being watched by British soldiers who, because some of them had telescopic sights on their rifles, would use those as scopes. You know, they weren't intending to shoot any children, but they're watching and that's what they look through because they don't have separate binoculars. So this very first action in this movie always made me feel a little weird because I kind of know,
for sure.
I know what that feels like to have somebody, well, in this case, the character's been voyeuristic and watching that naked couple frolicking, but, like, I know what it's like to be watched by somebody who is technically only using the scope as a sort of telescope, but they are pointing a weapon in your direction, and that's kind of unnerving always.
Absolutely.
Yeah, especially because they're not dressed like what you think of with police officers. They're dressed like they could be a rival gang. So for all you know, this could just be the quote-unquote biker gang of the movie trying to just pick off stragglers.
That's what I thought at first. I mean, I hadn't seen this in almost 10 years. So I thought this was that gang, but when it ends up being the cops, it's kind of a weird way to start off. Now these are Shakespearean actors, right, Mick? They didn't just get, and you mentioned this earlier, but they didn't just get anybody off the street. These are actually really well-respected actors, right?
Yeah, I mean, none of these people become as famous as Mel Gibson, but there's a lot of, you know, really talented Australian actors in this movie, people who turn up again and again in various Australian movies, and I'm going to just keep mentioning them when they crop up on the scenes, but this is the interesting thing. When you have a culture, certainly like Australia at that time, where you're still properly funding theatre schools, you'll get lots of talented actors, and Australian film and TV in the 70s, there's a government quota on broadcasting, so that Australian television has to show X amount of homegrown shows. You've got TV production companies like Reg Grundy Productions and Crawford Productions, and they're making soaps and they're making police dramas, and lots of actors are getting to work on those. And Sydney and Melbourne have theatre scenes and theatre schools, and there are fewer people in Australia than in, you know, US. but they still, you know, support the art. And you can actually see that in this and in a lot of these films from that era. There's interesting actors and there's some great acting.
Yeah, although we're not going to see too much good acting here.
Well,
I'll just say that right
now. I mean,
we'll see manic acting.
Oh.
I'll say that. So we're seeing the cops are laughing at this couple running away as we see a sign detailing how many deaths have happened here this year. And Mick, this is a real sign, right?
No. This is made for the film.
This is made for the film. I heard this was
real. No. I think this is a piece of production design for the film because that's a, yeah. God, I hope it was made for the film.
Okay. All right. I had heard somewhere that it was real, but I guess not. And then we pan back to some black leather boots. We see a police car that's in pursuit, and right away we get what the series is going to have a lot of, boys. We get a car chase. And you know what? $350,000. These chases, this opening chase, is pretty fucking remarkable. I'll go ahead and say that.
Oh, you can, I don't think you can really criticize the stunt work in this movie, considering this shoestring budget, all things considered, and the lack of, I would say, professional experience. So, above all, as far as being just a carsploitation movie, it delivers on that front. And I'm so glad, you know, this is not a two-hour movie. It's an economical 90 minutes, and the money's on the screen. This is not one of those cases of wondering where that $400,000 went. It went almost entirely into these vehicular chase sequences.
Yeah, no, it's a great opening action sequence. And it's also, I don't know if you've heard the philosophy Roger Corman always had with making this kind of movie, but he said you should always pay close attention to the sound mixing in the first reel and the last reel. You know, that's where you should furnish the most love on it. And this is the opening 10 minutes of this and the last 10 minutes are the bits where both sonically and visually the movie's working best.
Oh, God. There's no question about that. So they get away from these cops, but Mel's the one who's going to end up killing this, what we're going to learn as Knight Rider, which I could have sworn there was an 80s show about that with a talking car.
The difference is the car drove itself.
Yeah. So, again, so it's not just the Knight Rider who gets run off the road and killed by Max. It's the Knight Rider and his girlfriend, who's my favorite minor character in this film because she seems so supportive of the Knight Rider. All of the shots and things where she's kind of cheering him on when the chase is going well and then providing support when it seems to be going badly and he's getting emotional. But you know, we talked about actors here. Okay, the actor Vince Gill, who plays the Knight Rider, also very respected Australian character actor. He's in a fantastic Australian film from the 80s called Ghosts of the Civil Dead, which is a sort of dystopian prison drama that also has Nick Cave in it and is directed by John Hillcoat. Yeah, and it's great. But do you know who the Knight Rider's girlfriend is played by?
No.
Okay, the actress is called Lulu Pincus, and do you know who she later marries?
Yahoo Sirius.
Yahoo Sirius.
Holy shit! So she's like, the end of the osploitation era in the 80s.
Yeah, so she's like, I don't know, is she the Zelig of Australian cinema?
That is so funny.
Yeah.
Mick, I got to ask you something. And Matt, you might be able to chime in with this too. What is up with the use of birds in this movie? Because we see crows, we see vultures. Like, what is he trying to say here? Or did they just happen to be roaming around set and Miller just thought, let's just put that
in? No, there's some deliberate use of birds that they must have attracted them somehow. But like, it's the same way there'd be, you know, crows picking up the corpses in a Viking movie.
Yeah, it's just reflective of the ecosystem of Australia, where that country is basically every animal is designed to murder you.
Yeah.
In the meantime, we have someone in sunglasses listening to the police radio. And then we also see, now this was crazy, because I know Mel's kid dies in this movie. In the beginning stages here, we see this child wander into the street. Meanwhile, cars are getting destroyed, the chase wages on, and the kid is picked up and rescued before he's taken out. This is a bit of a bait and switch, because I thought coming in that Mel's wife and kid die in the beginning of this film, and Mel spends the entire movie taking revenge. No, that's not what happens, and this was pretty crazy. Now, it's obvious that this kid's not even in any hint of danger. They film around it really well, but still, this is pretty crazy to put a kid in danger like this.
It's a really nice piece of foreshadowing.
Yeah, that's what I thought of, too.
The whole chase is foreshadowing, because it's a... The Knight Rider is driving a black pursuit special, and is clearly now completely out of his mind. And his actions are also going to get his romantic partner killed. And there's a child placed in danger. And all of the themes of the film, in terms of Max's arc, are kind of all foreshadowed in this opening chase.
There is also the placement of this scene, notably with the kid, I think leads you, as a purposeful misdirect later on to think his son is going to survive too. Because it's like, oh, surely you wouldn't think they'd kill off a child. So I think that's, this is a purposeful inclusion in this opening.
This is a franchise with a high child mortality rate.
Yes.
All right, speaking of mortality, let's talk about the soundtrack here. Now, I got to talk about soundtracks every one of these podcasts. Now, we've talked about this composer before. The two of us have talked about this composer before. He did the soundtrack to Freddy's Dead. A guy by the name of Brian May, no, not the guitarist for Queen. He's some composer from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and this is a bad soundtrack. I don't like this soundtrack at all.
It's okay. You know, it works best when he's trying to be Bernard Herrmann, when he's doing sharp strings, and also when there's kind of... when there's low brassy instrumentation, it works great, but there are several sort of musical motifs and themes in this that really have aged very badly. I think it's a really effective score for a movie of this budget and at that time, and you know, you're kind of grading this on a curve. I think May did do some really good work on some other things. I think his score for the horror film Patrick is really effective.
Oh, yeah, that's a movie that Miller saw that made him want to get him on
this.
So, yeah, and that is a good soundtrack. I'll agree with you on that. So we see the first... Oh, go ahead.
I think maybe horror was more May's metier than, strictly speaking, action.
Yeah,
this would have benefited more from those, I think, of those early John Carpenter scores.
And that's kind of what Patrick is.
I mean, I kind of want to transplant something like that here, because as it stands, for something that was scored in the late 70s, oh yeah, you can tell.
Have you seen the American trailer for this?
No.
Okay, the American, trailer that AAP / Filmways put out when they distributed this, the trailer for this uses, are you familiar with the Tangerine Dream score for Sorcerer?
Oh yeah, of course.
Right, they use it, there's a cue from that, they use a track called Betrayal, that's also the music used on the trailer for The Warriors.
Oh yeah,
and it's this
great
kind of pulsing, sort of unnerving synth piece. And it's amazing. I kind of want an alternative universe where this movie got scored by Tangerine Dream.
I just watched Sorcerer for the first time last year. Man, what a film.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God, what a tense film. So good. We see the first driver of the cop car bleeding to death in the front seat, and Miller is filming Mel from the back, so we still don't have a formal introduction to him. We hear the name Toe Cutter for the first time as an interceptor heads right to him and then swings around. It gets right to his bumper as the car hits a pylon and explodes. And here's Mel, front and center. Hell of an explosion here, and as we mentioned, just a great, great car chase here.
Yeah. You've got all the withholding what Max looks like, and then when he steps out of the car, you know, Mel Gibson looks disconcertingly youthful.
He really does, and he doesn't have too many lines in this. He's hanging out with his wife and son, and his wife's playing the sax, which kind of, to me, foreshadowed the Lethal Weapon soundtracks, but we'll get to that when we talk about those movies. Mel's bad here, and I would really consider recasting if I were to do another one, because every time he's in the action scenes, he's fine. Every time he's doing something in pursuit, he's fine. But these one-on-ones with his wife and kid, oh my God, he is just terrible.
I think he's inferior to what he would become as an actor. But I think that speaks to him actually learning his craft. Because remember, he got this role because they saw him in a bar fight.
That's the legend. Well, yeah. Miller disputes that.
Yeah. I mean, he is a graduate of one of Australia's best theater schools. And, you know, in his graduating year, he did Romeo and Juliet with Judy Davis. I don't think maybe the problem is Mel Gibson not knowing how to act yet. I think the main problem is George Miller not knowing how to direct actors yet.
And that's a good point, too. For sure.
And this movie's, it's got the framework of a story, but I think it also winks at you repeatedly that we know you're not here for this.
Yeah.
Mel's making breakfast in black leather pants, and his wife is just not in the mood. He puts on a mask to try to cheer her up, but she just says, "Get out of here." They exchange crazy about you pleasantries as he heads out. We see Mel getting a new V8 engine, as we're hearing that people don't believe in heroes anymore. In this scene, in this car shop, I read something very interesting about it. For every angle, they had to move the things in the set to the camera angle. So if you're seeing it from Mel's perspective, it's behind the actor that's talking to Mel. And when they moved the other actor's perspective, they had to move that entire set of car parts and everything else to behind Mel to kind of make it look like there's a lot of car parts in this car shop, which, man, that is guerrilla filmmaking right there, boys.
Yeah.
We're seeing the... go ahead.
No, it's again, Max being shown the black V8 interceptor, it's a very, very Chekhov's gun moment.
Oh, God,
it might
yes.
be the Chekhov's yes. gun moment in Australian cinema. You know, it's a, it's so even if you've not seen this film before, you know this vehicle's going to figure in its climax.
Yeah, but this is also one of the great movie cars you will ever see.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. It's
so awesome.
Yeah.
We're seeing the crazies that Max has taken out, and Max hears that their friends are out to get him. We cut to the presence of a huge motorcycle gang, and we are once again hearing the name Knight Rider. They're trying to take revenge. We see the gang causing havoc on the town. Cars are being broken into, windshields taken out, and full-on cars are being destroyed. Miller uses a lot of close-ups here, along with one of a crow flying away, as we mentioned before. But he also does something else, and he does it in the car chases, and I wanted to mention it to you boys. There's a lot of close-ups of eyes in this.
Yeah. Well, this is very much... Everything with the bikers is a... More so a tribute to westerns, particularly both the spaghetti westerns and then some of the knockoff ones you were getting around this time, where it's a lot of close-ups on eyes. The biker gang acts the way that the gangs and, like, Fistful of Dollars would come into town and just act like they own the place. I think that's very intentional.
And the scene with the train station is very, it's got a very sort of Once Upon a Time in the West vibe to it. Somehow, and the actor at the train station, Barry Otto, is another one of those Australian actors who's in everything, and is the father of Miranda Otto.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I recognize that.
Yeah, so, you know, from the Lord of the Rings films, and...
Yeah. We'll be getting to those soon. Max and his partner, they're driving through, and we see one guy running through the field, as well as some of the gang who are kind of out of it, including a girl cowering while chained up. The guy from the gang is also yelling the same, Knight Rider. They're trying to take revenge. And they take the gang in as we see Charlie with a voice box, which I love.
Yeah.
But before that, this girl chained up, this is pretty harrowing stuff. Scary stuff.
Well, here. It's kind of weird because there's a double implied rape here, right? When the Toe Cutter and his gang attack that one vehicle with the couple in it. And there's a motif in this movie as well, which is a Australian couples just in this film seem to have an aversion to booking a room, you know? But the fact that we see before Max and his partner, the Goose, come up on the vehicle, they see the guy wandering through the field, and he's naked from the waist down and clearly in some kind of state of trauma or shock. So the implication is that the Toe Cutters gang has raped both of them. If I'm reading this correctly, right?
And one thing's apparent, if you're a partner named Goose in the 70s and 80s, you're pretty much screwed.
Oh.
And really wear sunglasses.
Yes.
Well, here's the thing about the Goose, right? Because a lot of the stuff in this movie is heavily influenced by other films that came out in that decade that are in the same genre or sort of genre adjacent. And I've got this theory about the Goose, because he's basically Moon Pie from Rollerball, right? They have the same arc.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of the same thing. The hero has doubts about his job, but his partner really loves it and is larger than life and is very enthused about the job he has that lets him hurt people and cause mayhem on a motorcycle, you know.
Now, this character of Charlie, this is a character we saw earlier, right? And he was burned up. That's why he has this voice box thing that he's using.
Right. Yeah, this is George Miller. This is a funny thing, right? When I was in Catholic school, in my sort of grammar school I went to was Catholic, so religious education was mandatory. And the thing we'd always be told was that if you're looking at the Gospels, Gospel of Luke is probably the most accurate one because Luke was supposed to have been a physician of some kind. Yeah. And I think it's this thing sort of bled through with George Miller, where in another action movie, maybe the character of Charlie would have been written out of the movie after that car accident, or he'd be fine, but he'd just be on crutches or something. But with this, we saw that he got an injury to his throat, and here he has, like, a voice box on his trachea, and it's like this medically accurate injury. And it's this theme in all of these movies, where the injuries are kind of medically accurate. When I learned that George Miller had been a medical doctor, it suddenly all made sense. All of these injuries and traumas... kind of, or sort of drawn from literature, medical literature, or from his experience, I think.
Now, this is around the time, too. I do think there are parts of this movie was cut to shit. Because here is when we're hearing exposition about the fact that no one showed up as witnesses in court, so they have to let everyone out and into Bubba's custody. Why is it that we just kind of hear about this and not see anything about it? It does feel like there's a lot of editing going on here, and some of the storytelling here is pretty disjointed.
I think that's because of two things. It's at least consistent with showing that society has not yet entirely collapsed. There's still fragments of law and order. But I like that you're seeing the infrastructure collapse in front of you, because the Hall of Justice, it's like slanted and decrepit, and the courts just seem to be there as a formality. So I like that the movie never outright says the state of the world is all for you to immerse yourself into. But I don't view the lack of a trial as a criticism, because much like the scenes with him and his wife, it's just there to give you base information, and the plot keeps moving. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. Would I have liked to see more? Yeah, sure, but the movie's also not really preoccupied with giving you a speech about the state of the world. The only commentary I do see for is that the movie does have something to say about mental illness, particularly with how it's untreated. Because if you notice, there's both the gang member, and there's also May's kid has some kind of handicap. So there's clearly no, like, there's hospitals, but there's nothing to support people with mental disorders.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of one of the themes in this is that the fraying of the sort of society in this film is taking its mental toll, right? And it's, you know, it's Max's fear that he articulates to his wife is that if he stays on the road much longer, he'll become a terminal crazy like the people he has to pursue. You know, it's all there. I mean, yeah, the film's called Mad Max, and I think we're supposed to think mad as in so angry he'll get awesome revenge, but, you know, the mad as in mentally ill is also a very valid reading.
If you're looking for intent, that's how you should interpret it, because he also, as we find out, has tried to quit multiple times. So yes. Clearly there's no, like, real good support system. So it's kind of the police state's own fault that he goes mad, in quotes.
Yes. And again, it's exactly the same as Jonathan Ian Rollerball. You know, I'm
You're going to make me want to check that out.
Oh, God. Rollerball has not aged well. I'll tell you that now. Rollerball sounds like it's going to be fun, and it's not a fun film.
We cut to the gang celebrating, and we see Johnny the Boy shooting a dummy out of paranoia.
Yeah. Shooting a mannequin in what feels like one of the film's many shout-outs to Clockwork Orange.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I meant to mention that, but you're absolutely right. A lot of Clockwork Orange here. We're seeing one of the gang burn his own arm with a lighter as he watches Goose zoom away on his bike. And then there's a monstrous stunt of him flying off his bike while it is in the air. This is crazy.
Yeah. We missed the cabaret scene?
Yeah. It happens right here. It's very brief. I didn't think to mention it just because it's so brief. But if you want to talk about it.
Well, it's the... God, you know, we talked about the music in this film having bits that are bad. But the bit where Goose goes to see the cabaret show... That the song the female singer is performing is very, very bad.
Yes.
It's very, very bad. But it's interesting it came because whilst she's singing it and Goose is looking at her, getting clearly very, very turned on by her and her song about...
Yeah.
Again, about how sexy she seems to find the men in leather who drive motorcycles. In the background behind them, there's like a couple up against the wall, kind of getting very intimate. And it's one of these great, like, background details in this where is everyone just so stressed that whenever they feel the urge, they're just going to get intimate, even if they're in the middle of the field? Is this the tension of this world kind of affecting people erotically? That's my question.
Well, why do you think there were so many COVID babies?
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah.
It's kind of obvious, you know. So Goose gets another vehicle, and then a brake drum is thrown through it, and he crashes yet again. Boy, this guy is just not having a good day.
No.
Toe Cutter torments another one of the gang members, telling him to throw a lit match, which he finally does. Max goes to the hospital as Goose's burnt hand falls, and how about this late 70s Gibson acting?
Well, it's the Gibson acting assisted with a really ill-advised sort of lap dissolve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a kind of wavy dissolve of the kind normally used in sitcoms.
Yeah, and he uses Star Wars wipes, too. I didn't know that.
Well, I mean, coming it's in kind here. Of... this might be the movie that uses the most sideways wipes. Certainly from an era when they would kind of had become passé. Like, when Lucas uses them, it's kind of like he's deliberately homaging, you know, like Kurosawa and older films that would have used them. And with Miller, I guess it's the same thing, but boy, it's an editorial technique that really places this movie in 1979.
For sure. We cut to Max's wife, who might as well have a bullseye on her forehead, as she walks the beach and sees that Max has a peanut butter and honey sandwich, and he tells Jesse that he can't clear his head, trying to put sense when there is none to have.
Yeah. it's never clear if Goose dies or survives. I was watching it again and thinking,
I know.
It's a bit ableist that he's just kind of, you know, because Max has that line saying, that thing in there, that's not the goose. And I'm like, well, it is. He's just very injured. It's never clear whether the goose survives or dies. And I kind of think, like in Rollerball with the equivalent thing, the character of Hoonpie is clearly brain dead and they turn him off. You know, so that character is a clear death. And with this, it's less clear. Is this Miller's medical expertise maybe working against the movie?
Yeah, and you know what? And if he did die, it would make more sense for Max to come in and just turn in his badge. But as it is, why the fuck is Max turning in his badge? Again, I think there's some editorial choices here that were just not well advised.
I think it's just the last straw. That's how I read it.
What about Captain Fifi McCarthy, Max's boss? I'm going to say this. 13-year-old me did not have the term leather daddy in my vocabulary, but I could sense watching this film that there was something oddly manly about Captain Fifi McCarthy, and I think it merits a brief discussion. I don't know. There's a lot of homoeroticism in this movie.
Oh my god.
The goose thing is not the only Top Gun connection you have in this movie.
No, but the fact that Max's boss is like this large, bare-chested guy with a shaved head. He's constantly doing non-macho things like watering plants. You know, yeah. It's kind of, I mean, he's still very gruff and macho, right? But he's kind
yes.
of, his whole vibe is, you know, Tom of Finland model, but 20 years later, right? I just remember at the time not knowing how to articulate any of this, but thinking, wow, there's something kind of gay here, but I don't know what it is.
Well, even some of the lines, like where he says, what do you want me to do, get on my knees?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And all of the Toe Cutters gang as well. There's so much strange homoeroticism in this movie.
Well, it's the second time we've had this discussion, because remember when we talked about Nightmare 2, we kind of had this similar discussion.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, I guess it's sort of weird. Is it bad representation or really great representation? I can never get my head around it.
So the chief is trying to talk Max out of turning in his badge, and he just tells him to take a few weeks off to clear your head. We didn't get this
property damage. Go ahead. God damn it, Riggs.
We didn't get this weird montage of Max and his family. This was different. This felt like straight out of a fucking Incredible Hulk episode. I was not expecting this in this movie. We get a monologue from Max about long walks he'd take with his dad. Again, Mel's just bad here. He says he doesn't want to wait 10 years to tell her how he feels before she stops him. Meanwhile, Max goes to get his tire fixed as Julie tells him that she wants to go get their son an ice cream.
Okay, this bit's... I need to talk about the mechanic where they go to get this fixed, because there's two things here. First one is, one of my first jobs, when I finished my first university degree, I ended up working for this internet startup company in the north of England, and I wasn't there long because the place didn't last long, but my line manager there was Australian, and his dad owned that location. He owned that actual scrapyard that they used as a filming location. And I remember him telling me about this, and that he was very excited one day because he heard people were filming at his dad's yard, and him coming home from school and expecting a big film crew and getting there, and there's a handful of people. And he says, there's nobody famous, but you can see that Mel Gibson's there, and he recognizes him as sort of like an asshole he's seen around town. And I just kind of love this. That's just this reflection of this. This is a really small movie. That you like a teenage boy would have been unimpressed by the crew and the personnel assembled.
This is one of those movies that I'm sure is a lot cooler for kids if you're watching it versus watching it get made.
Yes. And then the other thing is the mechanic in this scene is Nick Lotharis, who is later, I mean, he's a respected actor, but he becomes
He was the co-writer on Fury Road.
Yes, he becomes an acting guru as well, and comes up with this interesting approach to sort of approaches to theater. But he is the co-writer on Fury Road and Furiosa, and he's like Miller. He's another Australian of Greek origin, because George Miller's parents were Anatolian Greeks. So it's he's a person who's minor in this film, but comes back to the franchise in its last two installments in a big way, which is sort of interesting.
I didn't realize Fury Road had a writer. So as she's getting ice cream, Toe Cutter gets a lick of the kid's ice cream before Julie kicks him and then drives off. Pretty crazy little chase scene here. She's telling Max to get in as she's being pursued before Max can get his tire. Toe Cutter comes to the tire place right after Max takes off. Julie sees the dog playing with a hand that's hanging off the truck, which I thought was a crazy little scene there.
Yes, yes. Kundalini, one of the biker gang, has lost his hand. Also, one of the biker gang is called Kundalini, which is a weird Karma Sutra reference, as far as I can tell.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Ziggy says there is nothing to worry about as Julie and Max, they make their way to a very green part of town. They once again exchange pleasantries as she heads into the forest, which somehow leads to a beach.
Yeah. You know, given how dangerous this universe is, I kind of wonder about Max is really, I know he's on vacation. Max is a little bit laissez-faire about letting his family wander off, given that this is a film where
I know
almost all the other characters have a weird threatening vibe. Like, Mechanic has a weird threatening vibe.
Yeah.
Especially when he talks about, oh, you know, I've got these tires I could sell ya. Can't say where I got them, you know, and it's like, okay. So yeah, no, that's a bit weird. As somebody who's now a parent and a husband, I kind of feel different about these scenes now than I did when I was a kid. I'm kind of like, would you not be a little more present? You know, given this universe, right? Obviously, you know, I don't think my wife needs accompanied everywhere when she goes about, you know, but like, in this universe, though, clearly, everyone should just be armed already.
Yeah, you have a point, because as a kid, if you're watching this, you're like, oh my god, I wish I had a dad like that. He never tells his kid to come back. Like, he's letting his kid go wherever he wants. As an adult, you're like, what the fuck is he doing? Julie walks through the forest as she's chased by birds, more of these birds, and then finally Max hears her cries and runs out to her. They get her in the house, but she wakes up and realizes that her kid isn't around her. She runs out to look for him, and there's Kundalini and Toe Cutter with their baby. Toe Cutter makes fun of her lack of sense of humor as May shows up with a shotgun. This Aunt May, again, another character, comes straight out of nowhere. No build-up whatsoever. Here's this old chick with this fucking shotgun.
Well, an old lady who has leg braces.
Yeah!
Again, this is kind of like, you know...
What the fuck is that?
It's a strange little medical details that George Miller has thrown in here, I guess. The other one is that I kind of love about the scene where the Toe Cutter and his gang have the baby. Is Toe Cutter has tied his hair up into a top knot, but he has his biker helmet on his head, but at a weird angle, so we can still see his face, and the visor's open, so his top knot is sticking out through the visor, so this biker helmet looks like he's wearing like a Prussian military helmet from the 1800s. And it's just this really weird choice, and I want to know, did Miller tell him to do that? Did Hugh Keith Byrne, the actor, decide to do it in a moment of sort of, you know, actorly strangeness? It's one of these weird little details that I love that costs no money, but it's just so endearingly strange.
It is. And let's get this out there, too. They didn't have a wardrobe budget here. Everybody kind of came in their own clothes. I'm going to go out on a limb and say I'm 98% sure that this was all this actor's idea.
Yeah.
And not given to him by Miller.
Well, the thing about, one thing that's interesting here is Keith Burns and Tim Burns, who plays Johnny the Boy, and like the main cluster of the biker gang in this, had already played a biker gang in another Australian film.
No
There's
shit.
An Australian film from, I want to say, 1974, 1975, called Stone, which is a biker movie that's in which a tough cop has to go undercover with a biker gang. It's like a bad biker version of Point Break, and it kind of has a bit of a cult following. I think it's bad, but I should caution and say that I've only seen the UK release version, which is about 20 minutes shorter. So
it's like 25 minutes shorter.
Yeah, but these actors are kind of really convincing as a biker gang because they've already played a biker gang in another film. And these actors were all based in Sydney, but this film was shot in and around Melbourne. So because there's very little money, they actually rode the motorbikes production bought from Sydney to Melbourne for the shoot. So they had a couple of days on the road as well before they started shooting. So there's kind of there's a sort of nice camaraderie with them. And they're very convincing as a unit, I think, simply because these are the circumstances of that movie.
Julie runs off with the baby as May locks up the gang. The flimsy door falls down, and they go once again in pursuit. The baby continues to cry as the car stalls. She runs out of the car as May shoots at the gang. They pursue her on the street, and there's a quick cut of film, and we see shoes rolling with feet in them in the street. So we know what that means. I mean, this is a precursor to Pet Sematary, right, Matt? We're going to see this in a couple
of years. Yeah, except here they don't have they have the excuse of, well, there's no infrastructure, so we can't really build a fence on the highway.
Max finds the bodies, and Miller is smart to shoot this from afar. Because if there's one thing I remember about Mel Gibson in all his movies, he's one who finds these gals who, you know, he has an affair with or he's been married to. They're dead, so he looks up to the heavens and screams, and we know that he's in full revenge mode. We cut to the hospital, and here the kid has died, and Julie isn't much better as Max listens on. Max then grabs the mask, which was a weird plot point. I know we saw this earlier, but man.
Yeah, like it's not connected to anything. Like it's not Halloween heirloom or anything.
I think it's like a weird bit of symbolism, but it is just strange. This film has so many strange choices like that that again, I guess I find endearing, but it is an odd choice. That this is what Max is looking at, but then I keep trying to think, well, what would be a sensible object for him to look like when he's becoming deranged with grief, you know?
Yeah.
Well, the obvious thing would have been like a teddy bear or a stuffed animal or something.
Yeah.
Max then heads to the car place to find out more about this tattoo. We cut to a truck on the highway as Max is in pursuit of the gang via Charger.
Yes.
Oh, God. Again, you guys mentioned it earlier, but God, this car is so badass.
This car is... this is one interesting thing about this film. The series of films, and a lot of Australian exploitation movies. Australian cars of this era, especially the ones manufactured in Australia, don't look like anyone else's cars, right? Obviously, the V8 Interceptor has been customized from an existing model, right? There's been changes made to that vehicle's appearance. But even just the regular police cars, you know, these are models of cars that were made by Ford Australia, and... You know, these weren't available in North America, they weren't available in Europe. These are cars that, you know, if you're watching this from like a European or American perspective, it's like, you know, you'll see things that look a bit like a car you might know, but it's not that. And it's sort of like, you know the way Australia being a distant continent? They got mammals, but their mammals evolved along a divergent line, so we have marsupials. It's like, wow, this is like this. The cars are weird. They have the car equivalent of placental pouches, you know, and I kind of love that, but yeah, this part of the film, we get to see the V8 Interceptor properly, because we've seen it in daylight, and in motion, and yeah, that's one of the great movie cars right there.
Yeah, it's a wonderful reveal.
I like how all the cars in this movie, it's sort of like the precursor to Twisted Metal, where they're all just, like, these transformer machines of different, they're like car Frankensteins, where they're just parts from different manufacturers. Because I'm sure they're not really manufacturing new vehicles with the state of the world. So I like how that's kind of consistent.
And there's a couple of throwaway lines in this. You know, with the mechanic as well, when he thinks that it's... there's a couple of lines in the mechanics where there's a talk about they replacing the spokes on a motorcycle wheel, and, like, you would replace the wheel in our world, right? You know, there's things like that where it's like, okay, this universe is running on spares.
Yeah, it's the bare minimum just to keep something operating.
Yeah, yeah.
I mentioned with the Interceptor, that's like the last V8 engine they have.
Yeah. So Max takes a few of the gang members out, and I will say this scene is pretty fucking great. I love this fucking scene. Someone mentioned it earlier, but this movie is just wonderfully bookended.
Yeah.
You know, we have two really, really good car chase scenes here.
And the other thing about, like, the finale of this film especially, is it plays great without sound.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, I think George Miller said that, didn't he? Didn't he say he kind of wanted to make a silent movie without sound or something?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's very much like that. This last reel of the film plays so great. There's very little dialogue, and all of the action tells us everything. It's wonderful. This is I think the opening of this and the finale of this are the things that really sort of announce George Miller as a director to watch.
Oh, positively. Like, the movie knows how to hook you immediately and then grip you for the last 20 minutes. You can argue about how effective the middle portion is, but as far as what the ilk that this movie is cut from, I don't think it gets a whole lot better than this around this time period. You know, it doesn't have, obviously, the flash or the quick cuts of, say, The Chase and French Connection, but it's also a different style entirely.
I mean, have you seen the original Gone in 60 Seconds?
Yeah. No, I've only seen the remake.
Because I think the original Gone in 60 Seconds is an interesting point of comparison here, where it's a film made by somebody who'd never made a feature film before, and it has impressive carnage and vehicular stuff in it, but in that movie the connective tissue is very, very poor. And with this, there are issues, but they're not as profound as that. Gone in 60 Seconds is like, it's got great car chase stuff, but it's not imaginatively directed in the way this is, and all of it's people talking filler feels like filler from a foreign film. This has a sense of style about it.
We see bikes going over bridges as Toe Cutter picks up a picture of Max's family. Max stops and takes a look around as he's shot in the leg. He's having trouble reaching his gun as his arm is run over. This was crazy. I didn't remember this.
This is also the best acting Gibson does in the movie, because it's very authentic when he gets up and has to limp. And his like left leg, like the bone is shattered and he can't even put any weight on it. Like, again, I think that's Miller telling him, like, this is how you would have to move.
He shoots one of the gang members as Toe Cutter growls. Max limps to the interceptor, and it's a cat-and-mouse chase. He gets in pursuit and is right behind him and pushes him right into a 10-wheel truck. And again, Miller's shot of the eyes. Epic.
Yeah, and we see that shot again in another one of these films.
Yeah, I remember it showing up again later.
Yeah, and it's weird, because he does a trick with the eyes kind of popping out, seeing something so shocking. He does this again in Twilight Zone, the movie.
Yeah, he does.
In a section there. he does it much better in that, because here it is literally like a little very primitive little puppet thing, and producer Byron Kennedy is pushing these fake eyeballs out through these goggles. It's very quick. I mean, it works, but it's a crazy decision.
I don't remember this in Happy Feet.
No.
Max finds Johnny the Boy, who's babbling like crazy, as Max gives him a jigsaw-style trap. This was crazy.
You laugh, but James Wan, like, loves this movie, which is...
I know he does. No, I wasn't laughing.
Where he got that from.
Yeah.
I don't doubt that whatsoever, and I wasn't laughing at it. I just thought it was crazy that I saw it in this movie. I didn't remember.
Yeah. James Wan kind of built a whole horror franchise out of this scene. And if I'm remembering Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' Watchmen correctly, Rorschach does this to someone at one point, right? The thing that breaks...
I don't remember that.
Yeah, the thing that breaks Rorschach...
It's been years since I read it.
The man who's kidnapped the little girl he's supposed to rescue... And Rorschach gets her and finds she's already been murdered through Rorschach. Kind of devises a similarly grim punishment for the guy.
Carr catches on fire with his inability to hack through the handcuffs.
Yes.
In credits roll on Mad Max.
Credits roll in a way that's kind of, okay. The film has this great sort of action-packed finale, yes? And this is sort of, but unlike the action at the start, which is very exciting and high-octane, the action at the end of it, it's kind of brusquer, yes? Less about spectacle, it's more about... It's angrier, right? And it's kind of people individually being picked off by Max. And we have this, and we have this final shot, and Max is where the Knight Rider was at the start of the movie. He's a crazy person driving a Dolan black police car? Yeah?
Yeah.
That's where Max is. Mm-hmm. Max is now a terminal crazy. And, you know, this is a tragedy where, you know, this final shot reveals that, you know, Max has become completely dehumanized, yeah? In this world that's falling to pieces. And then the end credits cut, and we have some light jazz. We have this, I don't know, Perry Como stuff happening. That music cue for the end credits is just baffling to me.
It's a
perfect ending, right? You know, the Herman S. strings playing as Max is driving into the just further into the interior, and the shot from the car, and the white lines on the road, and, you know, the music going dun, 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 and it's perfect, and then the credits roll, and I what is that music?
Scale of 1 to 10, boys. What do we give Mad Max? I'll go to Mick first.
See, this is tricky, because I am grading on a curve here, and I'm mentally comparing this to, like, I've seen all exploitation films from this era. And I've seen like lots of American car chase films from the same decade. I'm comparing it to like the Brian Trenchard Smith films I've seen, which I don't think are as good as this. But I'm also comparing it to maybe slightly glossier things, like there's a great American film called Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. Have you seen this?
No, sir.
With Susan George and Peter Fonda in it, and it's... it's great, and it's directed by John Howe, who made Legend of Hell House. There's some scary Disney films. He made Watcher in the Woods, and it's just really...
Oh, wow.
And it's one of the films this movie borrows from a lot, right? And it's one of my, if anyone asks me for like a 70s cartoon film they haven't heard of, it's the film I always direct them to. And it's got great action, but also the acting's kind of really great throughout, and it's really well paced, and it doesn't have this soggy middle. So I'm thinking about that movie, but then I'm thinking about the lower, low-budget Australian fur, this is better than, and how great the start is, and how great the end is, and whatever way I calculate this, it always ends up being about 8.5 out of 10, where I think the strength of the bits that really work compensate for the bits that are a little less developed, or less successful.
So you're going 8.5.
But I'll say this, right? This is one of these franchises where the first film of the franchise is not representative of what will follow.
So 8.5.
But 8.5, yeah. But it's just, it's a, wow. I think the thing someone once said to me about the first Mad Max film, but it's not a Mad Max film, if you know what I mean.
All right. 8.5 from Mick. Matt, what about you, sir?
You know, not just because we reviewed it last year, but because I alluded to this earlier, I do think it bears a lot of resemblance to Star Wars in a lot of ways, this trilogy. Where I diverge and take a different fork in the road is that A New Hope is my favorite of the original trilogy because I do like how tactile it is in comparison to the other two, among other things. I don't feel the same about this one compared to at least one of the other movies we'll talk about. I think it gets the job done. It's effective. It's 90 minutes. It really doesn't overstay its welcome, but it's got a great opening and a great final 20 minutes, and there's some jerky stuff in the middle where parts of it feel like an Australian soap opera with the family. But I do think it's a certain amount of restraint on Miller's part to say, I know you're not here for this, but I have to put it in here so that this is something beyond just a car crash movie. So I do think there's that component. But above all else, it's for the budget. I mean, this thing, it's really well shot. The stunts are great. So I do, at the end of the day, have to put it in comparison with the other ones. So I'm going to land on a strong 7.
7 from Matt. God, you guys are making me be this guy, aren't you? I'll say this much. There is so much to admire about this film, starting with it actually getting made to begin with. I think the perseverance and George Miller getting this movie made and getting the job done with what little he had is a tremendous accomplishment. I think the beginning and end of this movie is just tremendous. And everything you have heard about the Mad Max series is personified in those two scenes. But this was tough for me to get through. I'll go ahead and say, I think there are portions in this movie that I look at and I think, God, something could have been added here. Not to mention, you had some pretty bad acting going on. And all of that kind of combines for kind of a tough watch. But again, the stuff to admire about it outweighs that. I'm not going to land on a 5. I'm going to land on a solid 6. Just because the stunts and everything in the beginning and end are tremendous. But I don't find this to be an enjoyable watch, and I doubt I'll watch it again. It's just one of those movies that it's too rough for me, you know. And I love independent film. Hell, I was a part of the independent film circuit for a while. I've made films like this, you know, not like this, but I've made films on these budgets where you have to do what you have to do to get it done. There are stories of them having a street for 15 minutes and them getting their equipment out and filming for very, very quick, and then all of a sudden everything was busy again. There are things here to admire, but that doesn't make it a great film. So 6 out of 10 for me on Mad Max. I will say this, though. As low as I was on the original film, guys, I am really looking forward to watching the next film, to the point where as soon as we hit stop on this recording, I'm going to pop on The Road Warrior, because I am interested to see where Miller takes this and how he takes what he has learned and puts it in his next feature. So Road Warrior is coming up next week. Matt, what do you remember about Road Warrior, Mad Max?
I remember thinking this was a Friday the 13th sequel because I saw Lord Humongous with the hockey mask. I thought this was one of those entries that I missed back in the video store.
Definitely has elements of that for sure. Mick, what are you expecting when we talk about Road Warrior next week?
I'm expecting this all to be much more enthusiastic because that film.
And you were really enthusiastic this week, so that's.
Well, you know, this is a fun series to talk about. You know, what I'm going to suggest you do before you watch Road Warrior, though, and it'll only take you 5 minutes, is there is, or at least was, an Australian electronic dance outfit called Pure Tone. And they had a big hit in the late 90s, at least a big hit in Europe, with a song called Addicted to Bass. And the video for it is a homage to the first Mad Max film. Mm-hmm. And it's awesome. It recreates the car chase from the start of Mad Max in this pop video. Tremendous. And it's awesome. The song kind of slaps, but the video is incredible, and it's like, it's recreating this thing that didn't cost much money, again, with probably a comparable budget, and it's really interesting to look at. That's my recommendation, Addicted to Bass by Pure Atonement.
I will check that video out. Yeah, I will definitely check that out. So that'll be next week. This is all leading up to a review of Furiosa, brand new Mad Max film. I cannot believe I am saying that. Coming out this year, 9 years after Fury Road. I have anticipation for it as well. I cannot wait to hear Mick's interpretation of that. Plus, I know Mick has teased that there is a Mel Gibson story that he wants to tell. I cannot wait for that. I think I'll save that for next
week.
Oh,
yeah. I have a Mel Gibson story. Oh, yeah.
I can't wait. We're gonna save it. We'll save it for next week. Come back next week if you want to hear that. But until next week, when we talk Mad Max 2 Road Warrior, that there is Kundalini, and Kundalini wants his podcast back. Thank you, guys.
How does it feel? It hurts. Out here, everything hurts. You want to get through this? Do as I say.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, exclusively on Percolated Media.
Welcome to another edition of Thunderdome!
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Anything I say. What a wonderful philosophy you have. Take him away.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, please take a look at some of our other retrospectives, where we delve film by film into such other franchises as Star Wars, the Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise, Indiana Jones, the films of the DC Universe featuring Batman and Superman, and so many more.
The Toe Cutter! He knows who I am! I am the Night Rider!
If you would be so kind, please take a moment to give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
The men, who are they?
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
How the hell did you get all this together?
Just happened, Max, you know. Beats from here to beats from there.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
I can do this. I know this machine.
He does. He's a rat hat.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is edited by Garrett. Men and a Retrospective Podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
What do you suppose he's gonna do?
Retaliate first.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
We ever saw of him. He lives now only in my memories.
Budget on this was between $350,000 and $400,000. Box office is over $100 million U.S. dollars. And this was directed by the one and only George Miller.
Yeah.
Sorry, I came loose here. This is directed by the one and only George Miller.
Doing this format, which was right around the time Fury Road was coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. So it just never...
But, again, the stuff to admire about it outweighs that. And you know what? And I'll say it again. If I were Miller and I had seen this performance by Mel Gibson, I would have recast him.
Well, Gibson was the second choice, right?
I know he was.
He wasn't like this.
He should have been the third.
Well, it's you know, one of these. There's an Australian actor called James Healy.
I've heard this.
You know, he was working in an abattoir, and Miller had seen him doing a guest spot on the Australian police drama Homicide, and thought he'd be perfect for Max, and he turned him down. Yeah, and
he turned him down.
Yeah, I just think, wow. What a
career defining role if he would have taken it.
But
I'm gonna land